now. You're listening to VoiceAmerica.com.
Annie, you're my angel sent from God.
Let's get ready to rock!
Hi, I'm Annie Armas.
Hi, I'm Robert Cornell.
Hi, I'm Michael Cornell.
And we're Annie's Dream Team.
You're listening to The Annie Armas Show.
Seek, and you shall find.
Ask, and you shall receive.
Knock, and the door shall be opened.
Faith.
Love. Hope.
And that's what we're talking about.
Here's Annie.
Welcome back to Annie Armand Live at voice.voiceamerica.com. I'm your host, Annie Armand, and tonight, the series that we are going to be talking about are Dangers of Psychiatric Drugs, Part 18. Topic for discussion, a close look into Napa State Hospital, exposing drug abuse, mind control, rape, sexual abuse, suicide, violence, and many more atrocities, regrettably so. Our featured guest, Wayne Walter Morin, Jr. And tonight, after 18 torturous years of lockup, he is finally free to tell all. Now, ladies and gentlemen, all of you who are tuning in, what strikes me most about tonight's guest is that he walked, experienced, lived in psychiatric prison, in absolute tyranny, so to speak, for 18 years. And tonight, he's here with us to speak openly in diligent efforts to reach out to you, to our masses across the globe. It's one thing to educate the masses through research and literature, also very crucial in our advocacy journeys in truth and awareness. However, if you're looking for real solutions, it is individuals like my guest tonight, Wayne Warren Jr., who are most qualified to talk, period. I commend our featured guest tonight for his courage in speaking out, for walking the talk, sharing openly, and a living solution himself. Also, we have a supporting guest by the name of David Sadler. Also, an incredible gentleman and an accomplished gentleman of many hats. He's worked as a laborer in cross-country pipeline construction, a semi-truck and trailer driver, 18-wheeler, from what I see here, a radio announcer, wasn't that great, as a computer salesman, manager, junior college computer instructor, and he keeps going on the list. But what's really impressive here, to top it all off, is that in 2002, he ran for Congress as a Republican from the 12th Congressional District of Illinois, defeating his Republican primary opponent 67% to 33% and losing to the 14-year Democratic incumbent by essentially the same margin. So with that said, hopefully we're going to have other supporting guests by the name of Lucky Meyer joining in. But I also would like to acknowledge Wayne's friend, very good friend, Shane Carlos Arroyo. And from what I understand, he's an inmate with Wayne, and Wayne will tell us more about it. But from the email that I did receive from Shane, just to acknowledge him and honor him on tonight's program, he was unable to be here, for those of you tuning in. And reason being, he was unable to leave his work for reasons that we won't disclose for tonight's program. Regardless, he was also in the hospital with Wayne, and before he met Wayne at Napa, he was in at Tescadero getting raped by a man who is now in his 60s, and he was 22 at the time when he was raped. This is, again, for those of you tuning in, I'm talking about Shane Carlos Arroyo. And he escaped his reign of terror once he got out. And there's more to be said about Shane, but I'd like to just acknowledge him for our program that he really, really, truly wanted to be here tonight, but extenuating circumstances prohibited him from being here with us. With that said, Wayne Morin, welcome to Annie Armand Live.
Me finding your email, and thank you everybody out there and Annie Solution and Annie's Angels out there and that listen to this show are people that need a solution, need to make their voice more than one. And Annie, let me tell you, Annie's like the trumpeter in front of what I see so far, and I've seen a lot on people saying they want to expose in Scientology and CCHR and all these groups that say they want to expose. But I look at Annie's show, and this one little page that she had talks more than all those groups combined together. Anybody that really needs some kind of help needs to check out Annie Armin Live, believe me, because there's just so many things that she has, from benzodiazepines to adult abuse, convalescent homes. I mean, the list just goes on and on, and these all have to do with mental health issues, and that's what basically my voice is to the people that are still in the state mental facilities, not a public practice from a psychiatrist in the community, but a state mental hospital. And the ones here in California are just full of crimes, and they are immune from outside investigation.
Just for your own protection, Wayne, do you, everything before you even utter any more statements regarding your journey, do you have everything factually backed up?
Yes, I do. I basically, if you go to my site that basically says the Wayne Morin tapes, I have tapes that I've talked to the Department of Justice. I went out to the state hospital, and basically at the state hospital, I basically talked to the chief investigators there, the police special investigators of the hospital, and it took me a year, Annie. It took me a year just to get there. First, what I had to do was write to the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and file my claims with the governor's office, wait for this constituent to get back to me. Constituent got back to me and then directed me to the Department of Mental Health. The Department of Mental Health then shot me back to where everything happened. But this took about a year of me filing papers, doing this, waiting for the deadlines to end. And then I finally got to paperwork where it led me back to right where it was, which was the hospital and the special investigators unit.
We're very thankful that you just announced that live on the air, not just for the station's protection, the show protection, but even more so for you, and also you setting an example for, there's so many, Wayne, out there, so many people that are truly, they're raped either mentally, emotionally, physically, in some shape or form by either government abuse or whatnot, but I always strongly encourage them. I don't care whether it's this show or the Oprah show or the Dr. Phil show, it doesn't matter. That 10 seconds or 10 minutes worth of hearing their voice is not worth it if it's going to jeopardize their life. And so I'm very grateful, and I know I can speak on behalf of everybody that's tuning in right now and will be tuning in these audio archives that will be available to them 24/7, way, that you have the factual backup for everything that you say. Bravo to you, and again, I commend your courage, because you are a walking, living solution, by far surpassing any expert that could talk about what you have lived through for 18 torturous years. Wayne, tell us, just to establish some roots, you know, and before we dive more into your journey as to how this 18-year persecution took place for you, what was your life like
before all this
happened?
All right, it's pretty interesting in a lot of ways. I come from a very dysfunctional family. I mean, probably one of the most dysfunctional. You know, when I watched 8 Mile with Eminem, I seen a dysfunctional mom and a dysfunctional family. But our family made Eminem's 8 Mile movie look like if he was sitting in a piece of heaven. We grew up 4 blocks from Haight-Ashbury, and this was during, I am now just about 50 years old. I'm talking about the height of the Haight-Ashbury, the Golden Gate Park, the hippie movement. At the age of 6 and 7, I was already buying matchboxes of marijuana on Haight Street in Golden Gate Park. My mother was basically, at the age 16, she gave birth to me. She was still a baby herself, and she then took up a job working at Connie's Bar in Broadway in San Francisco, where she basically was then introduced to many meth tabs, benzedrine, and marijuana in doses. But her second husband was a heroin addict. Getting back to me, she would come home at night, and basically I'd have to let her in, and I'd have to make a stool to lift up and put a couple of books on there, then reach up to the latch and pull the latch off every night. My mother was one of the kind of moms that basically at the time needed support in the family because there was no husband in the house, and me being the youngest man, I was like the fix-it man for everything. I'd go around looking for things to help and to fix. My grandmother at the time was already working three jobs to basically keep the house that we were living in, and my mother didn't have a clue what she really wanted to do. So basically you can see the type of era that I grew up in. It was four blocks from Haight-Ashbury, and at the time the hippies, there was nothing but hippies that lived around there, and they basically wanted to make sure that if you look into the Haight-Ashbury history, you'll see there was a lot of LSD, there was a lot of LSD experimentation, there was a lot of big bands of the Grateful Dead, which then used to be called the Warlocks. You'll see the Jefferson Airplane, you'll see Janis Joplin, you'll see the Manfred Mann Band at that time and era, which, you know, basically the Mighty Quinn era. And you'll see these people that were experimentation of LSD, speed, and hard drugs were given by the government. The government sponsored a lot of that what happened with Timothy Leary. And matter of fact, San Francisco has been used for an experimentation on human people for the longest time. These are noted facts. These are documented facts in the FBI files and in Freedom of Information Act.
Wayne, were you ever part of an experiment as the one you are describing right now?
I myself, not that I know of anyone like that. No, not with LSD or with not anything that anybody I'd ever found out that I was using, being like part of Project Bluebird or Monarch or MKUltra. But those come into another topic that I have been a part of. And I have talked to FBI agent while I was at the state hospital and had some things confirmed about them knowing about me and how far that I'd gone back and for how many years that when I was with the Mighty Quinn, which was like a 60s Jesus Christ to the people that were hippies and had cults. And
now,
in the Rolling Stone magazines and things like that, he was basically a cult, like prophet.
Let's go back to your family situation now, prior to the first incident, which pretty much led your admission into the Napa State Hospital. Were you in any way, shape, or form involved in the marijuana, drugs, or anything like that since you grew up in that type of an atmosphere, regrettably so?
Yes, you know, it was part of my life. My mother was
How
basically...
How old were you at the time, Wayne?
What ages?
Yeah, when you were...
Basically since I was two, three, basically being breastfed, marijuana was always in our... Mm. I was basically being... We were basically having marijuana put in our food when we were growing up at age 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. Marijuana was being sprinkled into my food, which my grandmother basically, it is a testimony to, when my grandmother heard about that, she was shocked when my mother told her, we've been putting in their food since they were, you know, 2 and 3 years old, and their spaghetti and their salads and their cookies and their, you know, anything we could find, their tea, anything we could do. We didn't eat all that good, but, you know, basically, but, you know, what we did eat, she made sure there was marijuana in it, so.
Now, Wayne, prior to your 1987 incident, when your lockup took place, how old were you when you were first admitted into Napa State Hospital?
12 years old.
And what were you admitted for?
I was admitted at that time because my mother my mother basically didn't have any place where she could, she didn't want me living at her house in Lagunitas. See, my mother basically, when the hippies all moved transaction from, when it got too hot in Haight-Ashbury, when the cops were getting too heavy, when the hippies needed to get out of there and find a place to relocate, they exodused. There's a big history behind the hippie movement. Hippies exodused to Marin County. And when they exodused Marin County, it was way out in the sticks, usually at Forest Knolls, Lagunitas, Woodacre, San Geronimo, Lucas Valley. And these are the places where you hear that the big bands, musician bands, basically moved out to. And what they did is they found really cheap rent, real cheap lodging. And that's where they became like the new Haight-Ashbury in the Marin County.
But coming back to you, what had you done at 12 years of age to have been admitted at Napa State Hospital?
Well, my mother didn't want me around the house because I was basically at that time stealing her marijuana from her. And I didn't want to crawl in the sack with her basically naked and basically to smoke her marijuana. We'd all have to get in bed with her and be naked and, you know, get high off her drugs, and I didn't want to do that, so I started ripping her off for her weed, and then she didn't want me at home. So what she basically did, she made sure that I got in trouble, and she made me fake ID, which was like, you know, any teenager nowadays can just about buy fake ID. But my mother made sure that she bought me some, and she told me not to come back to the house, and what she did is she made sure that I got into the state mental hospital. She even drove me up there.
Was it almost a revenge drive on her end, or to get back at you?
Yeah, it sure was. Matter of fact, you know, not only was it a revenge thing, that she said to me, if you're not going to live at my house and smoke my marijuana and basically do as I asked, and, you know, she told this to my grandmother also. She said, you know, then, you know, we're going to put you in the mental hospital. And that's what she basically did. She put me in the mental hospital. At that time, she had many friends. Elvin Bishop was one of her places that she used to go and party with Elvin. And then she was other musicians. I'm sure she probably knew about all of them that lived out in the San Geronimo, Woodacre area. That would be even up to Garcia. And I know my brother had met Boss Gags and his wife Carmilla, and, you know, Peter Tork lived in Forest Knolls, and so did Elvin Bishop. So she basically made her rounds with the musicians, and she was doing that to please them, but also to make a name for herself. She didn't really need my food stamps or welfare money anymore. She was just doing that because she wanted to be hateful to me and to prove to them that she would do anything for the rock scene, you know, the cool rock scene at the time.
Wayne,
you know?
When you were doing the marijuana, other than the fact that when you were born, you were being fed that through breast milk and whatnot, were you also doing the marijuana just to kind of escape mentally, emotionally, just to kind of numb yourself because of what you just expressed to us regarding what your mother was doing or expecting you to do? And I'm really trying to keep this as pure as possible because I can only imagine what the people are waiting for me to ask you, and I'm not going to do that because the show is not about ratings. And I know it's taken a lot out of you just to express all this. So I'm going to keep all the dirty laundry out the door. I can ask you all those questions, but it's not going to serve anything for the purposes of this program. But at the time, were you taking all those drugs just to escape and numb yourself?
Well, the
marijuana.
I don't think the viewers really know why I would. I at the time I was smoking marijuana, and at the time I was, you know, living in San Francisco. I didn't really have a clue why I was even going down to Haight-Ashbury to buy the matchboxes of marijuana. Just that my friends smoked marijuana too. I knew there was a smell of marijuana in my mother's house, but I didn't really know she ever smoked it.
We didn't know that's what you were doing.
Yeah, she knew that's what we were doing, yeah. But she basically didn't, we weren't hip to her smoking it. And she told us when we were 12 years old, she told my grandmother, she goes, I've been putting marijuana in their food since they were babies. And I even blew it in their face when I was breastfeeding them. And see, I didn't have a clue that she was doing that. And then what she did is she basically took us into her room and she introduced us to peyote and psilocybin and LSD. And from that time, we had to go to concerts with her. And we'd have to take LSD to go to concert with her. And then we'd have to, you know, smoke our marijuana butt naked in bed with her. You know, so I basically, I was, you know, a boy, a 12-year-old boy to the men out there. Basically, I didn't want to, you know, strip down in my skivvies and be in my bed with my mom. That made me feel really uncomfortable, so.
I can only imagine. Well, why don't we go ahead and fast forward that? I'm sure there are other shows that will be interested in the dirty laundry aspect of it, and that's not what this program's about. Why don't we skip ahead and go into your first admittance to Napa State Hospital at age 12. Tell me, what was your experience there like at 12 years of age in a state mental hospital?
Well, when I got there, they basically told me from Marin General, where I, you know, where they sent me up to Napa State Hospital, they basically had told me that there's going to be go-kart rides, there's going to be horses that we could ride, there's going to be an elephant train that shuffles me back and forth, I don't have to walk, there's long walks, there's swimming pools, there's go-karts, you know, there's all sorts of beautiful things. And when I got to the hospital, basically said, he told me that there's one horse and he lives on side of the hill there, and there is no go-kart ride. I find out there is no go-kart rides. I find out there is no swimming pools, but there was a little swimming pool, and I find out all the things that people had said was untrue.
And when you were there, what did you experience? What was the atmosphere like?
Well, the atmosphere is my mother came up there and she basically started to mingle with the staff members, and they started getting loaded together. They started getting high together. They started making sure they were controlling me from in there. And when my grandmother wanted to come and visit me, what they did is they signed a piece of paper saying my grandmother, my loving grandmother, couldn't visit me. And they made sure that from then on in, that I started smoking drugs with the staff, and it progressed from drugs to me getting to know the other staff members and having sex with them and using drugs with them like that, you know. And it became Ritalin, it became Dextrodrine, it became, you know, through needle injection too, so.
Why don't we hold off on that thought, Wayne, and I appreciate our supporting guest, David Sadler, holding on the sidelines in support of you. Hopefully we're going to try and make some time to hear from him as well and his thoughts on this. For those of you tuning in, this is the Annie Armand Live series, Dangers of Psychiatric Drugs, Part 18, with my featured guest, Wayne Walter Morin, Jr., and he is really telling it all after 18 torturous years of lockup and basic psychiatric tyranny in the Napa State Hospital. With that said, we'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back to Annie Armand Live, your radio voice for the voiceless worldwide, right here at voice.voiceamerica.com. I'm your host, Annie Armand, with my featured guest, Wayne Warren Jr., who is now telling it all after 18 torturous years of suffering through literally psychiatric persecution in the Napa State Hospital. And also on the sidelines is David Sadler, holding on patiently, ever so patiently, and hopefully we will sneak some time in there so that we can hear his input on what is happening on tonight's interview. Also, what we would like to acknowledge always on this show is respect for humanity. And Wayne, I hope you do understand that I can go into the dirty questions, but I am not going to go there. This is not a Jerry Springer program. I have too much respect for you and other human beings that come on board, and it just pains me to hear that you have lived through this. And what is inspirational in all this is that you are here today openly talking about this. I mean, my hat goes off to you, Wayne. With that said, you were just telling us about your first admittance, so to speak, at the Napa State Hospital at age 12, and you were talking about what was occurring there and then what the pattern of behavior you got into with drugs and all that. And from what you said, also having sexual encounters with staff members there, because that's pretty much what was happening. It seemed like it was one big orgy thing going on. I don't want to put thoughts into or influence any of your statements, but it's just disgusting to me what you told me at the end of the first segment. And if I'm assessing this incorrectly. Please correct me now.
No, you're very correct, because I was a minor at the time. I was not an adult. And these people were basically, you know, they have the keys. They have keys to their authoritative figures. They're people that are elected officials that have credentials that take an oath to basically say that they basically are, you know, are there to guard people, are there to protect people. And what they did is they did the exact opposite. And, you know, they seem to be now immune, like the millions of the thousands of Catholic priests that basically were doing the same thing. You know, they get shipped to another facility, or they decide to up their roots and move and go to work at another hospital.
No,
you know,
Wayne,
I basically have, you know, such a condensed story, you know, with basically telling the Department of Justice what I told, and basically, you know, having all these years that I had to be in there and see these kind of atrocities, and the immunity from these people have at the hospitals, especially, there's no outside investigation ever really made. These last 3 years that I've been out, since I've been singing to the Department of Justice and went this route, I've had blessing after blessing to be on talk shows and like yours, and basically be able to tell people the atrocities that go on there, and the newspapers are listening, and the people out there are asking questions. I get letters, and I get emails, hundreds of emails sometimes a month, from different family members, and basically ask me, you know, do you know this client here? Do you know what they're saying seems to be similar to what you have on your site? And this is one of my family members, and we just start to discuss it. You know, so many times I get involved with the family members, and a lot of times you'll see the story that they're writing, and they'll never write back because they're just so afraid to basically, you know, after they know that the person is me and I really was there and I talked to them, they're just so afraid that for the family member that's still in there, me being a voice to these people, you know, I need to tell more people about the immunity they have. The whole hospital is rigged. Everything you do, and that's why I don't know. I was hoping that Lucky Myers would show up on the show.
I know. I checked with our engineers, and she has not been able to contact Colin yet. And because the time is just zooming on by.
Yeah, it is.
It truly is zooming on by. Let's go ahead and keep going with our getting as much information out as possible. And you said that you were also going through some, because I really want to go into the 1987 incident that led to the 115 times, basically, that you've been admitted into the Napa State Hospital. But one thing is very important to note, that you never had one single felony charge. So that is very important to note. I want to make sure I have that announced right on live on the air on your behalf. Now, you said that you were going through some needle injections. Now, were the staff members injecting this stuff in you and basically to have sexual encounters with you?
Yes, they were. There were staff members there on the eight units while I was still a minor, just about ready to be an adult. Though from the age 12 on up, I went from the children's division to the adolescents. That's the adolescents, which is more like in your 14s and 15s. Then I went to young adults, and that's before you basically get to be an adult. That's your 17s and 16-year-olds. I was on all different units, so basically. Yes, I. That's what they were doing. They were we would use Dex. I was on Ritalin, and what they would do is I'd have Ritalin injection, and we'd go to their place in Fairfield, and basically have sex in their trailer and things like that. The staff knew about it. The doctors wrote the medication for it. They knew about it, and I've named those doctors, and I named those things to the people at Napa State Hospital, the investigators, and they say they're checking on it, and that's a subject for another day. But I don't see them really checking too hard, too fast.
Apparently.
You know,
why don't we
a lot of evidence that I left on these tapes and other talk shows. I don't see them, you know, pulling any doctors or
people
over.
Well, you just keep plugging away, Wayne. You just keep plugging away, and believe me, someone is bound to check into it. The more you do these type of programs, the more somebody is going to be actually doing all that checking. So we can't give up hope there. You've come a long way, Wayne, and we all commend you, and we're backing you and supporting you all the way. Now tell us about the 1987 incident. What happened?
What was my admittance there to the hospital?
When you went back in 1987 with that whole fake bomb threat.
Basically, in 1987, as you read on my bio on your page, it basically says that, let me give you a little bit more in-depth about that. Basically, I was living, when I finally was released, and I was out from around 81 to 87. I basically was out for those short years. I basically, there was a lot of prophets like Hal Lindsey and Jimmy Baker and, Gary Falwell and the early 1980s, and there was that movie The Late Great Planet Earth, and that was basically for, you know, people showing the end of the world was going to happen around 1988 or 1981, or and every year that you went through from 81 to 88 there was another prophecy coming out. Well, it can be 82, it can be 83, and people were on their toes because we were at the height of the Cold War.
And how did this affect your whole fake bomb threat situation?
Well, how it did that was, well, I'm going to get to that in a second. And basically what I'm saying is that through those years, basically when I lived, when I was in the free world, basically I had moved to, when we were living in Calistoga, I became drunk. I started getting drunk because I realized that people were talking with me about the failing of the rapture. And that's all for another story, but what it was making me really feel that I needed to drink to get these feelings off my mind, to escape the feeling of the rapture not happening, and me trying to tell people it wasn't going to happen, and exposing to people it wouldn't happen, and going to the movie theaters and handing signs out and saying the rapture won't happen, and being shunned on, and it never did happen. I started to drink, and I started to drink so much that when I was in a little town called Calistoga, where they have a big program, the Seventh-day Adventists, they believe in no alcohol and no drugs, which is very commendable, but that's basically part of the religion, too, that they use the Seventh-day Adventists as their St. Helena Hospital, which was run by the Seventh-day Adventists, which is a drug and alcohol detoxification. You see a lot of commercials. I don't know if you see them down there in San Diego, but they have them up here. And then there's Duffy's, which is there's Bob and there's Bill, and those are the leaders of basically the AA groups, the 12-step book.
Forgive me, Wayne, I'm going to try and have to speed this up because we have less than 5 minutes before we go into the break and really get into how this affected it and what prompted you to do this whole fake bomb threat that, you know, got you admitted back into the Napa State Hospital.
Okay. Well, I was getting drunk so bad that I was going from store to store, and no one would sell me alcohol or beer, or I was up to drinking a gallon a day, and I finally found a few stores that would sell to me, which was Safeway, and then all of a sudden they said they would not sell to me alcohol anymore because someone in Calistoga told them that no one was selling me alcohol in Calistoga, so why would St. Helena sell me this store alcohol? And this was in a Safeway. So basically they said, we're not going to sell it to you anymore. And what I did is I went home and I basically drank some cooking sherry at the house. And what I did is I made a little egg timer and I called in the bomb threat, and I basically gave my address, home phone number, and where I lived, and basically the police came to see me and said, Wayne, did you call in a fake bomb threat? I told them no, and they basically sent me down. They told me to stay around the Calistoga area. What I did is I went into Napa and I started living under a bridge. Now, this was back in 1987, and basically got drunk about 7-8 more times and got pulled in by the jail, by the police in Napa, for being drunk and disorderly. Basically, they decided to press the charges on me from...
Now, Wayne, why did you say no, you weren't the one that called it in, when you're the one that called it in and provided them with the number to contact you?
When you're feeling that no one's gonna... I was an alcoholic. I was in denial. And I believed that I was being persecuted, and because no one would sell me alcohol. I had ID, and basically every little store I went from the little grocery store to the mom and pop store to the restaurants to the bars to the liquor stores, no one sell me alcohol. So it got to be a pattern where no one would sell me, and I was never acting like a slouch or a big drunk or, you know, belligerent and things like that. I was wearing nice clothes. I was ashamed, and I had ID, so basically I believed it was persecution, so that's why I did that, you know?
And what, okay, so now before you did this incident, one important question I forgot to ask you, when you were 12 years old back in 1971, how long were you, when you were admitted into the Napa State Hospital, how long were you there before this whole 1987 incident?
Oh, okay, well...
Just in terms of number of years or months or whatever, so that we can move forward from the 1987 incident.
Okay, well, you know, that I from that time, from my first admission, I had 115 more admissions than 1987. So
how long were you, when you were 12 years old, what was the period of time?
Probably 6 months the first time, and then 8 months the second time, and then, you know, 13 months a year, then back to 2 months, or, you know, the month it's varied, you know? The time of the month varied, and I basically, I didn't do from age 12 to 18 all of them years straight there. My mother would come and try to pick me up, and then she'd kick me loose to the street again, where I basically have to go to jail sometimes at the age 12 and 13. And this is another story I wanted to tell you about. I have IDs. I have my rap sheet that said I was in city prison, at the age of 13 and 14 years old. And I did 6 months there, just like I was doing it in Napa State Hospital.
So what did you see the difference between being in prison and being in the state hospital? Was there any difference, or were
yes,
they were
there
you basically
was.
Treated the same?
We got
less than 2 minutes.
Okay. When I was in the jails, the older men looked out after me. They protected me. They wouldn't let any of the deviants or the molesters or the serious rapists that were so rampant in the 70s. You know, you had all different sorts of serial killers out there killing people and leaving them outside highways and things like that. No one would bother me or try to approach me, because the older fellow people, or the older people there, would look out for me.
Actually feeling safer in prison than you were at the state hospital.
Yes, I was.
Why don't we hold off on that
state
thought?
Hospital, you know, that basically, when I was a kid, a child there, you know, I couldn't see my mom. I couldn't see my grandmother. I didn't really want to see my mom. And, you know, it was like the staff would bully me then. You know, they would socialize fights. So, you know, basically back at that time, you could be restrained up to 6 months to a year. You can actually be tied down to bed in those days for 6 months. And
Wait on that, Wayne, because we're going to run into the next commercial break. And I am so sorry. This show is really zooming on by. And hopefully we'll capture some of the other atrocities that you did experience and witness at the Napa State Hospital. But that said, don't go away. Everyone is tuning in. This is The Dangers of Psychiatric Drugs, Part 18. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Annie Armand Live at voice.voiceamerica.com with my featured guest, Wayne Warren Jr., and our supporting guest, Dave Sadler, who has been so patient standing by on the sidelines. We were hoping to get Lucky Meyer in, but as far as I know, we still don't have Lucky on board. And Wayne, the topic, as we know, tonight is about taking a close look into Napa State Hospital, and boy, are we doing that with your help. And we thank you for all that you are sharing tonight with us. So consider this perhaps another contribution to you, and hopefully we can get Shane on board. I'd like to dedicate next week as part two. There's no way we can get all this information out in 18 years of horror in a one-hour program. It's virtually impossible. So why don't we go ahead and mark your calendars. I'm putting the producer's hat on. Mark your calendar for next week live. It's for you again, and Shane will be joining in. So now, because the segment is about antibiotics, so everyone that's tuning in, you're going to have to hang on tight to your seats and buckle up, because all those atrocities that he just barely touched upon, those are going to be detailed next week. But for now, Wayne, we just established basically the root of how it all started and it all began with you, which was very necessary. I'm not sure if that's been done on any other program, but I think, you know, we had to establish those details of your life so that we can understand better as to your journey and what led to you, you know, for you to be here tonight with us. Unfortunately, you have to go through all that to do what you're doing right now and making a difference in millions of lives. So I'm going to ask you this question. Do you believe, knowing what you know now, Wayne, that you were to go back, and if you were to live, I can't even say normal because the word normal is quite relative, if you were to live a life that was not dysfunctional, so to speak, do you think that you would have even faced any of these situations?
No, because I had my grandmother. My grandmother would took me away all out of this. She was trying to take my brother and sister out of it too, but you know she couldn't find an attorney or anybody at the time that would handle a case. That back in those days, Annie, a grandparent didn't have any power, but the parent, even if it was a single parent, had the power. So she basically cut off all ties with anybody trying to investigate us, and she time after time again tried to get attorneys and lawyers and things like that. Contacted the governor back then when it was Reagan. She did all this stuff to try to get me in. Yes, I believe that I would have had a different life, and I would have been in a good school, and I would have learned drums, and I would have learned all those things that all the things that boys.
Now we're talking, Wayne. You and I could have played drums together.
Yeah.
You know, Wayne, why don't we invite David into the conversation with us?
For sure.
Because this segment right now is about solutions. You being a walking solution, and I know after having a nice, dynamic conversation with David last night behind the scenes, that this man is nothing but about, he is all about solutions. So, David, you on board?
I'm here. How you doing, Annie? Hi, Wayne.
Doing great now. We're much better now because we have you on board with us, and hopefully we can share the rest of the minutes that's left to hear your solutions after hearing the introductory journey, so to speak, of our Wayne before diving into the 18 years of torture, which is going to be exposed next week more in detail. What do you have to offer as a solution, David?
Lanny, thanks for having Wayne on, and as you can see, despite the horrific childhood that he had and a lack of education because of it, he's certainly not at a loss of words and a loss of descriptions to be able to transmit to everyone about his and vitally important, and Wayne's doing a great job. He's on a mission. He's getting the word out. He's going to allow a lot of people to avoid
absolutely the walking solution.
One of the things that jumps right out in listening to his story is that, as he said, kind of like the Catholic situation, this is not information that is not known. These types of abuses have been known in these state hospitals for years and years and years. Nothing has been done. It's time for accountability. It's time for government to do something that cleans up this thing. All of this is known. You've got to understand that the criminal justice system, of which state hospitals are part of their business. A lot of state contracts, a lot of state jobs. All of this structure requires a steady flow of customers, and those would be the inmates coming through. Here he never was really charged with a felony, and yet he found himself caught up. So we've got a lot of laws on the books, necessary crimes out of behavior that really isn't criminal. Yeah, it might be medical, it might be social, but it certainly isn't.
So what can you offer, David, as an antibiotic so we can bring Wayne in, because we unfortunately have less than 4 minutes?
Well, Wayne needs to keep doing what he's doing, and right off the bat, I think once he makes this, more people aware of the situation, and if he would just point out that this, continue to point out, he did point out, continue to point out, this is not unknown material. It's well known, and nothing is being done. And so we need a total shift in our government, bring accountability to our government. In order to do that, as we discussed last night, it's a government discussion, so I don't really want to get into it here because it's taking too long.
I know, we have less than 4 minutes.
But that's what we have to do, to think, Annie, that we are going to appeal to the government that we've got to solve the situation. Authorities to do something about this, we're actually going to do something about it, is naive.
Absolutely.
Because they already know about it, already been brought to attention. They already know about it. People who don't know about it are hearing this for the first time, and probably sitting back saying, I had no idea. Wait until the second part of the program.
Oh, I know. And you're coming back next week, are you not?
Well, let's let Shane come in there because he's got personal experience.
Oh, we're definitely, that's the whole point, but as a supporting guest, like you were on the sidelines there, queuing us, we got 2 minutes. Why don't we go ahead and hear from Wayne as a solution that he can offer, drawing from his 18 years of journey, torturous journey. Wayne?
I just want to start this off by saying that thank you, and basically I'd like to dedicate this last part to David Hoover, who passed after doing 20 years in the hospital, was a roommate of mine for at least 9 years. I've known him for more than 20 years when I was growing up there at the hospital. He just got out of Napa State Hospital in 2002. He was released in January. He passed. He died in his sleep. And I just want to dedicate this program mostly to him. And you know, because and his mother, because I used to listen to him talk to his mother on the telephone every day, and you know, discussing the horrors that went in there. And his mother had to listen to it for 18 years, and she only had her baby for three years free out of all those years coming to see her, him, and all that time. And you know, it's reasons for people like that that I keep doing what I'm doing, and to the families. And because I can. And it's wrong for them to do what they're doing to people. It's wrong, and they need to know, people need to know that their sickness, their immunity, as long as we have a voice and a microphone and other people can listen, they're going to listen, they're going to find out more, and maybe they'll get caught up in the statute of limitations, and they'll get busted, and they'll get the cuffs slapped on them, and they'll go to jail too. Huh? It's, you know, it's just, it, they're just sickos behind a badge or whatever, behind the walls with a key, and it's not right. It's not right at all.
Wayne, we're being cued. We don't even have 30 seconds left. I can't thank you enough for all that you have shared thus far on part one of the dangers of psych drugs, part 18, in taking a close look into the Napa State Hospital and exposing the drug abuse, and we haven't even gotten into the whole mind control aspect of things, and you already talked about sexual abuse, and you basically talked about death already, dedicating the show to your friend David Hoover. And we're going to be hearing from Shane Arroyo next week, along with Wayne. So next week, Dangers of Psychiatric Drugs, part 19. Same time, 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And please check the audio archives. They will be posted at AnnieArmondLive.org. So for everyone that's tuning in, good evening, and please forward these audio archives to everyone you can think of and educate the world.
Welcome, Annie, Armin Show.
To all Annie Armin Live and Antibiotics fans, thank you for your genuine support.
Welcome to the Annie and Armin.
Antibiotics are going to kill that infection, that failure, that infection. Procrastination, it's something that people can easily apply to their lives.